So we continue on in our fighting dark and satanic forces with the armor of God, and we're doing a deeper dive into the armor of God. So yesterday I kind of felt it coming on. I was getting a scratchy throat, and it was a really busy day preparing for stuff here and other stuff having to do with family. And so by the time the evening came, I was just really kind of wiped out, and so I had done some work on my message, but just really wasn't there, and so I went to bed early, and when I got up, I had full laryngitis. So what you hear now is surprising me, but as I was trying to get ready for today, I thought, well, what do I normally do for laryngitis? And so I took some medication, things like that, and then I took my vitamins and my supplements because I'm trying to retain, the former glory of what I used to be physically. So, and as I took the supplements, I felt one of them, which was a larger pill, just below the windpipe, get stuck right here, and I couldn't get it out. So I drank about 24 ounces of milk trying to force it down. It wouldn't go. And for the next 40 minutes, I had this thing stuck in my throat. And I didn't want to try and cough it up because I was afraid that it would, what's it called when it goes in? Aspirate into my windpipe. And then I could feel it begin to swell. The supplement itself began to swell, and so I took some hot tea and honey, and I thought, well, maybe that will dissolve it, and maybe the honey will make it slide down a little bit better. But I just really had to maintain my cool because it's very odd to feel like you have something stuck there and to know that it's just maybe an inch or two away from your windpipe, and then what happens then, right? I didn't want to wake Ruth because she had not slept well. And so I couldn't take my shower because I thought, well, if I do have a problem, that's the worst place. You'd want somebody to find you. So, I did nothing with that. But I just want to tell you that today I'm speaking on the belt of truth. And what better subject to silence me on than the belt of truth? I'm not trying to be overly dramatic. I'm just saying to you that it was a confluence of interesting things that took place this morning, and it just so happens it's what I'm talking about this morning is the belt of truth. And we live in a culture today that works very hard to silence truth. And so we cannot be silenced. But maybe before we cannot be silenced, maybe we need to appreciate the significance of it and exactly what truth is. Because truth and the lack of truth have enormous consequences and blessings. There are great blessings for people who embrace the truth. And there are enormous consequences for people who do not. In our culture, our society, and most of our people are utterly lost. They are rudderless on the issue of truth. The battle for truth is the battle of our time. In Jesus' day, the battle for truth had to do with Judaism and the Mishnah, the oral tradition of the elders, and Greco-Roman philosophy. So when he talked about truth, he was mostly addressing those kinds of things in his day. The Mishnah, although well-intended, was 1,500 years of oral tradition written down by the elders that if you were to put it in a Microsoft Word document, it would be 20,000 pages. And then Greco-Roman philosophy was incredibly erroneous and toxic in its time. So that's why Jesus presented himself as the truth, at least in part. Today, and these are $64 terms, but the battle for truth has to do with postmodernity, progressivism, scientism, where, at least with science, they most of the time talk about absolute truth when it comes to the physical world, but when it comes to postmodernity and progressivism, truth is all relative. In that economy, to speak on truth as an absolute necessarily means that you will hurt someone's feelings. And if you hurt someone's feelings, then it's inappropriate and it's even hateful. So in today's world, you will hear this refrain oftentimes, I am living my truth. And you can live your truth. Of course, the question that begs to be asked is, what if your truth interferes with my truth? Well, we'll figure it out. Which is why you see that coexist sign on many people's bumper stickers, because that's really what it's all about. None of those religions, none of those worldviews can exist with each other if you take any of those worldviews to their logical conclusion. They have to give up something in order to get along with the other worldviews. Truth is ultimately what is really real and the blessing and the consequences regarding it. Truth is always about freedom. Freedom from bondage, where Jesus says, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Deceit is always about exercising power over someone so that you can have control. Deceit is always manipulative so that you can control people in a way that benefits you but does not benefit them. The enemy is deceitful to put you and I in bondage. Truth is what sets us free. So if we want to live in bondage, then we will ignore the truth. We will ignore universal truth. We will ignore moral truth. We will ignore biblical truth if we want to live in bondage. Now here's the problem. The problem is most believers are not proficient with truth and with the word of truth. For almost 2,000 years, the idea of truth in the church was something that they would go to the wall about. I mean, wars were fought over what biblical truth was. It was unrelenting. It's only been relatively recently that the church has backed away from what biblical truth is, what moral truth is, even what universal truth is. In May of 2022, Barna published this survey. 37% of U.S. Christian pastors have a biblical worldview. Only 37% of Christian pastors have a biblical worldview, which the researchers equate with orthodox teaching. You hear me say that word, orthodox, all the time. The majority of pastors, 62%, hold a syncretistic worldview. Syncretism is the blending of religious faiths, not Baptist with Anglican or Presbyterian, but it's Christianity with Hinduism or Christianity with Voodooism. I mean, if you want to see where syncretism is, just go to Central and South America. There's been, it's unbelievable the syncretism that takes place with the Christian faith in other animistic kinds of faiths that are a part of their world. So, that's 37% of Christian pastors have a biblical Christian worldview. That's the majority of pastors who do not. Here are some others. God's nature. 50% of American adults embrace an orthodox biblical world, a biblical understanding of God. Only 50%. Salvation through Christ, 35% of American adults believe Jesus is the only way for salvation. We just read in the gospel reading, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, the life. There's no it's the. It's definite article. It means the only. I am the way, the truth, the life. Only 35% of American adults believe that Jesus is the only way. 65% do not. Human sinfulness. 27% of American adults recognize that all humans are sinful by nature. It's called total depravity, original sin. That's been a staple of the church for 2,000 years. It's only been relatively recently that we do not believe this. It's been a staple of belief in Western civilization for 2,000 years. Only 27% of those people believe that. If you do not believe that all humans are sinful by nature, then there is no need for Jesus on the cross. So Jesus must have lied about himself. Reliability of the Bible. 46% of American adults accept the Bible as true and reliable, less than half. In terms of absolute moral truth, 25% of American adults believe in the absolute truth rooted in the Bible. So, for example, when we take the Ten Commandments, the Ten Commandments are what are called apodictic law. Apodictic law means that these laws are true for all people in all places at all times. It is universal. It applies to everybody in the world in which we live. It's apodictic. All people. Not just people in the West, but all people globally speaking, apodictic law applies. Only 25% of American adults believe in absolute truth rooted in the Bible. The study found that the size of a congregation has an impact on the pastor's likelihood of holding a biblical worldview. Pastors of small churches, 100 a few, only 41% of those pastors hold a biblical worldview. Pastors of mid-sized churches, only 101 to 250 adults, 45%, hold a biblical worldview. Pastors of large churches, 251 to 600 adults, only 14% of the pastors hold a biblical worldview. This is self-reporting. These are pastors who have reported on themselves. This is what they believe. And then, of course, mega churches, over 600 adults, only 15% hold a biblical worldview. Now, they probably should read Revelation chapter 4, the Church of Laodicea, because so much of this is an attempt to appeal to people. It's a marketing mindset. But I do want to say this. We give too much credit to the world. We give too much credit to the world. Why do I say that? Because the problem is most believers are not proficient with the truth and the word of truth. We have too many people who are believers who have not perpetuated their faith to their friends, to their family, who do not hold pastors accountable about what it is they're teaching in their churches. Do you know the word of truth? Do you know what absolute and universal truth is? Nate will tell you, when we went to Geneva, that was something we talked about in humanities. We talked about it in our biblical, and we took three separate classes, 12 credits worth of Bible, of biblical studies, where we talked about absolute truth, moral truth, biblical truth. We took 4 semesters of humanities, where they talked about those kinds of things every semester. We were fairly proficient in talking about what absolute truth was, what universal truth was, what biblical truth was. And you know what? That was a standard discussion for people who went through, if you were Roman Catholic, CCD or catechism or confirmation. You talked about those things a while back. And those things have been surrendered. So the battle for truth, and this is what the enemy doesn't want you to know, and I'm not trying to be overly dramatic, but maybe it's true, there was maybe an attempt to silence me this morning. The battle for truth is the battle of our time, and if we are not engaging in that battle, then what we do is we do not know what is true and what is not true, and we are far more susceptible to bondage. Caleb was just talking about the fact that he's a mental health practicer. He would not call himself an expert, but a person who practices mental health. And as a person who's done a lot of counseling myself over the years, I can tell you that's the issue. What is really real, what is truly true in terms of how this person sees themselves, how they see their relationship with other people, etc. And helping them to get to see what is really true, embrace what is really true, come to terms and at peace with what is really true. But if they believe lies about themselves or lies about others or lies that have been told about them, from their parents or their family or whatever, it's toxic. It's pathological. And it's devastating to people. Embracing truth is enormously important. And being proficient about what truth is enormously important. So we read here in Ephesians chapter 6, "Finally be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil." And that part of the schemes of the devil is to deny you truth. It's all about deceit. It's about lie. It's about falseness. "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day." The only way we withstand the schemes of the devil in the evil day is by taking up the whole armor of God. And when we don on that armor, to be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. And that we do this having done all to stand firm. So then, after he says to do all this in order to stand firm, he goes right into verse 14 where he says, "Stand therefore, having fastened on the belt of truth." In the military, particularly in that day, to stand in a battle meant to enhance your effectiveness and your survivability exponentially. To fall in a battle meant that you made yourself helpless. You couldn't maneuver. You couldn't wield your weapon. You couldn't use your defenses. You were vulnerable. So this word stand has a military application. That when we're fighting a battle, and whether we all realize it right now or not, you're fighting a battle. You're in a battle. And so, in a very short order, to stand firm and then stand therefore, having fastened on the belt of truth. So that word stand is sete, which means standing firm or to be established. Having fastened, that word fastened is a Greek word, which I can't begin to pronounce, but it means to gird about. And then the belt is the word cingulum. And I'm going to talk about that more in a few minutes. And then the word truth is aletheia, which means reality versus illusion. What is really real versus what is illusion. Remember, illusion is deceit. Illusion is falseness. So let's talk about the belt of truth. Now it's interesting, how many of you have a KJV? Anybody here have a KJV that you read out? Okay. In the KJV, It doesn't say, stand therefore having fastened on a belt of truth. It says, gird up your loins. That's not the actual word-for-word translation in the Greek. So when the exegetes in 1611 put together the KJV, and by the way, the KJV is actually a pretty responsible translation. It's just that they were trying to be a little more creative here. They were adding an interpretive element to this, to their exegesis when they put this together. But what they did was they mixed the warrior, the Roman warrior, with the Palestinian warrior. Now understand that when the Apostle Paul was writing this in Rome to the Ephesians, when he was writing Ephesians, the book of Ephesians, he was in Rome under house arrest. And probably, as was common back then, he was chained to a centurion soldier. So he had a guard watching his every move, and he was chained to him. And the Apostle Paul, as he was writing to the Christians in Ephesians, knew that in the city of Ephesus, it was a city that had been fascinated, long fascinated, with witchcraft and the occult. So this is why he's included some of this language about dark forces, spiritual forces of the heavenly realms and things like that. Because he wanted them to know that they were those things were true, but they could be victorious over those things. And so the Apostle Paul was looking at this Roman centurion who at the time in the history of the world was considered to be the most fearsome warrior on the planet. And he was saying, I want you to be like the most fearsome warrior on the planet because of who you're fighting against. So in a metaphorical fashion, he took this Roman soldier and he borrowed from the armor that the soldier had. And so what the KJV exegetes did was where they were saying, well, you know, in Palestine, what they do when they're about to fight a battle is they gird their loins. In other words, they wore robes down to their ankles. And if you tried to fight with robes down to your ankle, you could not stand firm. You would trip over they would tangle up in your feet. And so they had a belt that they put around them, and they took these straps, and they went down underneath, in between their legs, and they pulled that up around and tied it on each thigh so that their feet and ankles were freed up. And so the exegetes for KJV were trying to say, look, this is what you have to do to stand firm. You can't be tangled up by stuff. So there's an interpretive element to it. So, in any case, that's what's going on in the KJV. Now, when we talk about the belt of truth, this is what we know about them. It was called the cingulum milrare. It was a Baltic-style belt used to carry the gladius. If you can go on to the next one. Used to carry the gladius, which was the short sword. So when the Romans fought with these big shields like this, they would almost hook their shields together, and then when they were fighting, they would take their short sword and they would jab at people between the shields. It was their primary weapon. There was a pugio, which is a type of Roman dagger, which you probably pulled out when you did fall. The loculus, which was a small storage pouch. And the baltia, which were hanging straps. But that belt formed an integral part of their armor. Most notably, it's what the gladius hung from, their primary weapon. Now, here are some other interesting things about the cingulum, or the belt. The cingulum for the Roman soldier was the mark. In other words, it's the thing that identified them as a Roman soldier, the most fearsome warrior on the planet. So it was the status symbol of being a soldier. It was worn at all times, even while off duty. Only Roman soldiers were permitted to wear this belt, and it was used to demonstrate their status. You could know a person was a Roman soldier in all that that meant simply by the belt that they wore. So, of particular interest for the using the belt as a metaphor of truth is this. Why address truth before the breastplate of righteousness, shoes for the gospel, the shield for faith, helmet for salvation, sword for the spirit? I mean, some people, well, why not faith? Why shouldn't faith be addressed first? I mean, I think that the question is, why the belt, and why did you address truth before everything else? I think that's a good question. So the significance of the belt as truth as a metaphor is this. Number one, it's circled around the body and its most vulnerable parts. Your stomach was very vulnerable. Many of the Roman soldiers' other weapons were dependent upon the cingulum. Unless unfastened or cut through, the cingulum was the most secure and almost impossible to dislodge from the body. The breastplate could be pierced, shoes could be torn off, shield and sword could be dropped, and the helmet could fall off. But the belt was the most secure part. What should be the most secure part of our life in terms of our faith? The truth as it relates to God. It encircles us. It cannot come off. It's almost impossible. It's the most secure thing. We know the truth. And everything else is derived from that. Number two, the significance of the belt of truth as a metaphor. So he's saying this, metaphorically, in the same way that the belt of truth was worn at all times during war for fighting for the Roman soldier, and while off duty to signify that they were a warrior, so too the Christian must wear their belt of truth when you're fighting and when you're off duty. No matter where you go, when people see truth in your life, they know what you are, and they not only know what you are, but they know that you are fearsome. Is that how people look at you? Is that how they look at me? Do they see truth wrapped around us? Not in an arrogant sort of way, but that, you know, one of my favorite philosophers, Soren Kierkegaard, says, no one knows the truth inasmuch as he is the truth. That we've metastasized, we've taken truth and we've made it a part of us. In fact, the original word for theology was theologia, and the word theologia means to study God's word in such a way that what you study becomes a part of you. The knowledge of God becomes a part of what you are. Nobody knows the truth inasmuch as he is the truth. And the only way that happens is when the truth is wrapped around us and it's so secure, it cannot be dislodged. And so many other things that we have in life, the armor that we have in life, is predicated, is dependent upon that belt, truth, knowing what is really real, what is truly true. And we do that through study, through listening, through prayer. Christian study used to be such a part of the ethos and the environment of every church.
And now, because of how the world has gone, we can't seem to do Sunday school anymore. It's difficult to get enough people together for Bible studies or mentoring or discipleship. There's a reason why exponentially the church, by and large, is becoming more and more ignorant, stupider and stupider when it comes to the things of God and biblical truth and being able to have a meaningful, enlightened, challenging, convincing conversation about what truth is, what universal truth is, what absolute truth is, and being confident in that, what biblical truth is, and being able to articulate that. Here are just some examples of absolute and universal truths. I had some other different kinds of truths, but I don't have time to get into it. But I do think it's helpful to go over things like this just to give you a taste. These are examples of absolute or universal truths. God exists. He is spirit and is eternal in his nature. God is omniscient. He's all-knowing. Omnipotent. He's all-powerful. He's omnipresent. He is everywhere at the same time. He is immutable. He never changes. He is infinite. He goes on forever and ever. And he is holy. There is only one God. He is sovereign. He created everything. God is all-loving, gracious, good, kind, merciful, patient, faithful, holy. God is just. God is the lawgiver. God is our judge. Those parts sort of fall off in many of the churches I'm talking about right here. God has revealed himself and his expectations to humankind. God reveals himself through the created order, through the imago Dei, that is to say that we've been made in the image of God, and so because we've been made in the image of God, we can know things about God because we've been made in his image, and he has given us his written law. Mankind is fallen, he is rebellious, and needs the work of God, needs the work of God's only Son, Jesus Christ, on the cross on our behalf. Now, here's the thing. I mean, it took me a little while to come up with this list, and it's not exhaustive. 50 years ago, your average confirmation student in 9th or 10th grade would have known all this. Your average CCD kid would have studied this. What has happened? If we don't have this as foundational to what we understand truth to be, then we can't be compelling. Then we can be deceived. And if we can be deceived, we can be put in bondage. We lose our freedom in Christ. Before you leave here, as we celebrate the Lord's Supper this morning, choose. Choose this morning to do what you need to do to put on the belt of truth so that it encircles you and that everything else that you do in the name of Christ is informed by what is truly true. And really real. Choose this day to pursue truth. The people who are coming here today, most of them do not know what is truly true and really real. Allow them to see God's truth in your life, to know the truth so that you are the truth as you live in their, in and among them as they come here today.